Blog Talk Radio.
Your philosophy, you change your thought pattern. Once you change your thought pattern, you change your attitude. Once you change your attitude, it changes your behavior pattern. And then you go on into some action.
We'd like to welcome everybody today to On Point with your host, Ron Edwards, and myself, Don Allen. Hey, Ron, how you doing?
Fine, Don. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great.
All right.
Beautiful day here today. We're going to dig right into the show. We have a special guest today on the show, Mr. Lenny Chisholm of Springboard Development Corporation here in Minneapolis, operating out of North Minneapolis and doing moving and shaking some people in bodies. I'd just like to give a little background. Earlier in the week, there was some controversy, and I posed the question that if there are no jobs available, why keep funding training programs in North Minneapolis or in Minneapolis in general? And I thought it was a valid point, and I wasn't really picking on anyone, but several training-type organizations came to the surface in conflict with my story, and the rationale is, there's a big difference between a social mission and a business venture. And so there was some back and forth with a leader of a local OIC here in the Twin Cities. And, we have Mr. Chisholm on the live on the air. Hey, Lenny, how you doing?
Pretty fantastic. I'm glad to have be on your show again there, Don.
Okay, all right. And, we just want to get into this. I mean, why don't you just lay out kind of what's going on with that and how that applies? And actually, both of us were kind of the at the tail end of some pretty harsh and sarcastic conversations via the email, and I think they were unjustified. And part of that is, too, let me just, set this up with full disclosure, is that, there's a lot of brothers running these organizations that have Caucasian women in the background calling the shots. And it's pretty interesting to see that this particular head of the OIC posted an email that was supposedly sent to me on May 11th, 2010, asking me to put together a proposal for this particular OIC, which, of course, I never got because she did not obviously check her email and find out that I had a new email address. So this got kind of heated. And also, just one more thing here real quick for you, T. Lenny. I shot a video with one of the students from the OIC that said, his buddies weren't getting jobs. I mean, they're going through this training and you have a large gap of people that are not. So, Lenny, what are your thoughts and views on that?
Well, I think what the issue for me with the OICs in particular is that they have to be part of the process where the jobs are also being demanded from the white female DBEs that are getting the contracts to show compliance for construction, for the construction industry under the Title VI program. If those companies are not hiring also out of the OICs, then we have a problem if the OICs are training and they're using the OICs as a mechanism to say we are making every effort we can to satisfy and hire people. That's where, to me, when I was in the meetings, one of the OICs, which is in St. Paul, said, well, in all my 25 years, I've never had any of the DBEs come to me to try to get workers. So thus, not only should you pick at the prime contractors in this process, but the OICs have to be also aggressive in forcing one of the huge pools that's getting the money designed for minority businesses, which are the white females, to also hire from their programs. So if they graduate five people and all five are supposed to work for the prime contractors, and then none of them are supposed to work for the women-owned firms that get contracts, then we got an issue. Because we know that if we have more minority-owned firms, African-American in particular, getting contracts, then we would have more people hired out of our community because theoretically that's how the program should run. We're not getting that. And that's where my frustration lies with the OICs, that they got to go out there and pick at those small white DBEs as aggressively as they pick at the large prime contractors.
Okay, and that's a very valid point. Now, also, you know, I'd like to share with you, and you already know this, Mr. Edwards and Mr. Chisholm, is that on June 9th, the Star Tribune reported a story. It was called Twin Cities Has Widest Jobless Gap by Race. And it was from a think tank. The report was done by a think tank called the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and it stated, just for some background here so we can build a foundation, it says unemployment among blacks was 20%, second highest in the United States behind Detroit, compared with 6.6% among whites, which even if blacks had the exact same educational profile as whites in Minneapolis, they would still have a much higher unemployment rate. Well, on July 20th, another report came out that said, alarming new report, pre-recession unemployment rates may not be reached for a decade. And it says Congress appears to have underestimated the profound effect of the current recession on the labor market. A new report for the Center of Economic and Policy Research, that's CEPR, released by the Jobs for America Now Coalition, shows that with the current path and the recovery, they don't expect the job and labor market to get straight, you know, to start to get straight until 2014 and then fully straighten out in another decade. So I incorporated this into the story that I put together because it just made sense that if you're not going to funnel or change the ways that you're doing things to actually create opportunities on the tail end, then we're actually wasting dollars. Your thoughts?
Well, I presume you want me to chime in there, or is that Mr. Edwards?
Yeah, no, go right ahead, Lynn. Let's hear it.
Here's the problem I have with the concept. We could give the OICs, let's say we gave them $20 million to train people. And if that $20 million is supposed to be used and quiet the rest of the people because they say we're training them. Well, if we got $20 million and we gave them in contracts $140 million, in this case, out of the Obama administration, we've given them almost $1.5 billion in contracts have been let out in the state of Minnesota in construction contracts. So let's say we gave the OICs, and I know they haven't gotten anywhere near $20 million. That $20 million would be wasted money because if we can't get those same people to working on jobs that they're training, we are not funneling the money out of the construction contracts into the community. That's one of the issues, because if you're giving all that money for training and you're not being able to funnel that money out of those workers that are coming out of the training centers because the contracts are still going to the same people, how are we supposed to break the gridlock? So when I say that, let's not give the money to the OICs, and that's the reason why, because if we can't funnel the money out of the construction contracts, out of those jobs, we need to work on a different way to create jobs within our community that can attract money. And whatever that would be, if it's restaurants, if it's movie theaters, if it's computer companies, manufacturing companies, we will have to use that money instead of giving it to the OICs because the fact of they're not able to get the money from the construction jobs for the people that they've trained. That is why it's so important for this concept to be utilized in a manner of training people so that the jobs they're being trained for actually can attract money and produce money. We're not producing any money out of those jobs. It's very, very small.
But let me ask you a question, Lenny, with that, and because I want to do a little historical piece. It's always important on blog radio, talk radio, that we also share history so that people have a context to deal with. Is it your feeling that, you know, what you just expressed is excellent, on point, but do you feel that the OIC leadership, because OIC actually is a national organization headquartered in Philadelphia, Do you feel that there's a lack of philosophical understanding of what the mission statement of the OICs first created under the late and legendary Dr. Leon Sullivan? Do you feel that the current leadership here in the Twin Cities doesn't recognize that or that they've abandoned that philosophy that you just enunciated?
Well, I don't know a great deal about the OIC philosophy, so I'm going on the concept that if you're training people, as a, someone that graduated from various institutions, once they get trained, their goal is to somehow generate money. And I came through under the programs that, you know, the 60s children created, the Pell Grants and stuff like that. I got that to go through college. So what the goal was that I would become trained and go out in the workforce and then bring money back to the communities and stuff like that to become one of those type of people. Well, if you're training people and they're not able to go to that next level, if that was the OIC's mission, that they would be able to go out and get jobs, then the jobs they're being trained for currently aren't being filled by them. So the only people that are benefiting under the current philosophy would be the institution. And if the institution isn't hiring a lot of people within the community, educators, et cetera, which we know that's not the case based on the what we've been able to see, then how are we supposed to grasp the training dollars that are coming in? We're not getting that.
The reason I asked the question, and so that's in the right context, because you're absolutely correct. You're out of an altogether different generation, almost two generations removed. The historical piece that our listening audience locally needs to know, and internationally, et cetera. OIC first opened for business here in the Twin Cities, two separate OICs, one Minneapolis, one St. Paul, in 1967, under the late Reverend Stanley King, a very dynamic leader, very dynamic voice for a period of time. He is now deceased. But I remember Dr. Sullivan coming here in 1967. I had just returned from the University of Syracuse as an example. We knew what the philosophy was. The philosophy you just enunciated a couple minutes ago about the rotation, if you will, of the dollars, the rotation of the economic opportunities was something that was the cornerstone of the philosophy of Dr. Sullivan. The Reverend Stanley King and others for a number of years here doing the OIC under their leadership really pushed and promoted that, and in fact it oftentimes kept them in confrontation, if you will, and conflict, which I think was good, with the quote-unquote established order, that being city government, the private sector, and et cetera. My observation, and I'm very familiar with this, has been that somewhere in the last 8 or 9 to 11 years, maybe even a little longer, OIC went in a different direction, though they certainly did not, you know, hesitate to continue to receive residuals for their institution, in other words, their salaries, okay, their benefits, their compensation. And the whole issue of the rotation of wealth and et cetera, you know, got lost. And I'm just wondering why the current leadership and the current board of the local OIC is not addressing this. And maybe it's something that people may have to decide to approach the national board of the national OIC and ask for a review of the approach here, because the OIC here, and OIC basically in St. Paul has pretty much taken a secondary level to a more high profile publicity-wise OIC in Minneapolis under Louis King. But I'm not sure that there should not be an assessment and an evaluation of the local OIC by the national parent group, which controls it, just like the Urban League controls its local organizations, the NAACP controls their local organizations, and et cetera, because we're getting too much information. You were with us last week, Lenny. We're talking in terms of the most recent DOT piece, $116 million, $0 for African Americans, and yet the current OIC Minneapolis pontificates on the fact that they are in the forefront of providing opportunity and access for African Americans. And as Mr. Allen just pointed out, the study of June 9th and the reinforcement, which, by the way, was covered on the front page of the Thursday's edition Minneapolis Star Tribune, jobless drought could last for years. That was the headline, my friends, above the fold, continues. And we have, other than these quote-unquote email exchanges, we do not have what I think is a firm philosophical position. And I know that the OIC of Minneapolis has enough intelligent minds there to make us understand where the mission statement departed from the the desire and the mandate and the manifesto of the late Reverend Leon Sullivan?
Well, I think what you mentioned, and I'm glad you gave the listening audience the historical side of it. A lot of the organizations that were founded by leaders of the past were founded under the pretense that they had to get something done because African Americans were suffering such disparities.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of those organizations have went from that level to a more of a social level now. So they're not aggressively changing and aggressively going after public policy changes and legislative actions to make our environment better. And we all know that we have to have legislative actions and things to make the environment better, and we got to have some pushing to make the environment better. So if those organizations are receiving money and they're not pushing the system, and if you train 100 people and you can't get 100 people jobs, but if you knew they couldn't get jobs going in, we know we can't train 100 people because the system won't absorb 100 people in the construction industry right now. It won't do that because there's too many white construction workers laid off, and they're saying, we're not going to hire your people. I don't care how many you train, we're not going to hire them. So we got to figure out a better approach to getting them into the game, getting them employed. So when I looked at this situation, that's why I said if you're just going to pick at the prime contractors, then that is causing a problem because the prime contractors are going to say, well, we hired disadvantaged businesses, which should be part of where African-American businesses are fitting in because we don't have the capacity to be prime contractors. Well, they're not hiring the African-Americans, which from the Nixon administration and George Shultz and Art Fletcher, to give them a little idea, they created affirmative action to help break the deadlock of union jobs out in Philadelphia. And Ron, you probably know more about this than I do,
mm-hmm.
but they created that. And they said if we give the jobs to set aside job programs or set aside contracts for African-American contractors, they're going to go out and hire their people. They're going to hire from people within that they know. They're going to bring in their – and that's going to allow us to bring those construction people in, which we don't want to have working under our firms. So everybody
right.
was kind of okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's not occurring now with the white females that are receiving contracts because they're now part of this disadvantaged business pool, then we have to say, where are they hiring their people from? They're getting the contracts, but they're not bringing in the same people out of the pool. So they're not bringing in Asians, Hispanics, Somalians, Africans, all of the people that fit into that disadvantaged business pool. That is where I think the philosophy of the OICs might have to be shifted in their strategies, and not just forcing the primes, but they got to force those subcontractors. And so that's, to me, one of the things that the national can come in and say, we want to look at how we're putting pressure in the system. And now, could that work? From what I've been told, the subcontractors, which are primarily white women, white female headed companies, are not hiring from the OICs.
Absolutely not. And, of course, that's the reason that you came under fire. And, in fact, I was in a meeting one of the rare times I bothered to go to the minority contractors meeting. I think it was January you and I were there. You raised that question, and I saw nothing but panic in the room. There were three Caucasian females who were there. Two of them were worked for state agencies, Mr. Allen, and the other one was a so-called female contractor. And I knew that was going to be a problem, and I think it's important also historically that the issue of the female pass-throughs really began to emerge in the late 1980s and the 1990s, and one of the more specific projects that it began to come into play was, to a lesser degree, the stadium, the Hubert H. Humphrey Dome, but it came into play on the jail, of all places. The county jail, the Hennepin County Jail, and there was a lot of pass-throughs that were going on with white females. The then civil rights director of the city of Minneapolis was Bubby White. Mr. White wanted to try to deal with that. Unfortunately, there was a decision by the state Supreme Court which indicated Minneapolis then, as it does now, has no jurisdiction to interfere with the county or the state or any subdivision of the state. Let me just also reinforce this, what I said to you earlier, then the documentation is in place for those naysayers, Mr. Allen,
yes.
is that much of what Mr. Chisholm has said is a part of the doctrine and the manifesto that was laid out by the late and legendary Dr. Leon Sullivan, founder of the OICs of America, as early as 1964 and 65, particularly 1964 as the final crafting of the Civil Rights Act of that particular era, later to be signed by Lyndon Baines Johnson. See, folks want to distract us from the relevance and the existence of history, gentlemen, because as they're able to do that, they make it appear that these are new philosophies, these are new doctrines that we are discussing. And as a veteran of the civil rights campaigns, I'm not flustered. I'm angry by the fact that this is being allowed to happen and that more of my contemporaries are not speaking up and saying what I'm saying just now to our listening audience, Mr. Allen, that we've been here before. It's not that this is a new philosophical doctrine and approach coming out of the African-American community. There's another part of history, very distasteful, that we're going to have to deal with, and that is the circumvention of the doctrines developed by people like the late Dr. Leon Sullivan, Stanley King, the first head of the OICs in Minneapolis, the legendary Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, who you played at the top of this program, Marion McLeod Bethune, Fannie Hammer, people like that. I mean, on and on, infinitum, if you will. And until we also begin to recognize that and contest that amongst ourselves as African Americans, we're going to continue to take this whipping that we're taking.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think the doctrines of the past were designed to break these gridlocks. Well, when you bring people into the system who no longer are willing to push the system, and I always think that's one of the toughest things, is you got to keep people pushing the system so that you get some type of something has to bust. And I like to use another analogy, and hopefully this will fit in. Until the oil pipe busted for deep water drilling, no one wanted to talk about all the regulations that did not exist or things that were not being enforced and things that were not in place. But time it busted, everyone wanted to now start to look at the system. Mm-hmm. Well, how did this take place? Why did we have these type of things going on? Who turned their head? Who closed their eyes? Who turned out the light? That's what's occurring here. If you have people that aren't looking at the system, and we have a way to look at these DBEs that are getting these jobs. There are laws that are on the book. There's Executive Order 11246, which said if you get a contract over $10,000, then you have to now adhere to affirmative action guidelines. Mm-hmm. Then you have the Office of Inspector General out of Chicago, which looks at the federal highway contracts to see if there are pass-throughs. Those people have to come in, and then also if you have the OICs putting pressure on those that are getting jobs that are not hiring, not besides the prime contractors. All of these things work together to form a body of checks and balances. And that's how you get back to what you're referring to, Mr. Edwards. The philosophies that created these organizations were designed to bring people into it. And if we're not bringing people into it, then how is our community supposed to take advantage of all the dirty jobs that are coming? I call them dirty jobs, the construction industry jobs, that are taking place that they're training all their people for. I mean, that's kind of what I look at as being you have to have a whole system pushing and pulling and making agitation, advocacy, and agitating so that we have these things taking place. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Mr. Edwards, and also Don?
Oh, I fully concur. Yes. But I've already indicated that there is an historical precedent for what you just said, what I just said, and it is etched in stone or is on parchment, if you will, just like the Constitution is. And I've already given the honor roll of African-Americans who were very much involved coming out of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and the 1960s with this philosophy and this doctrine. And as I said before, this is not something that is alien to the Twin Cities. Some would have us believe, many of the big white contractors would have us believe that this is something new. I knew these men when they were younger men. When they sat in rooms four rows removed from their bosses and heard young African-Americans deal with this philosophy, there would be occasions where powerful African-Americans such as Dr. Sullivan, and we had our own giants here such as the legendary Frank Alsop, Dr. Thomas Johnson, and others. And so I know and am a testimony to the fact that this philosophy, this doctrine, this history is known. It is not foreign to the individuals who are the giants, if you will, the founders of Mortenson and Ames and Krauss Anderson and companies like this, and some of those that are the larger subcontractors who have found it to be very comfortable to be subcontractors because they and the major developers slash contractors work hand in hand and recycle these enormous contracts and monies. And so to your specific question, again, it has been a debate, a discussion. Sometimes, in rare occasions, it has been a part of a legal litmus test, if you will. The African-American community has prevailed. Sometimes it is not, because most of the time we are directed towards the administrative process as opposed to significant federal cases within the courts. But bottom line, gentlemen, and wrapping on this, is that it is not like this is something new. It's not like somebody, we just all came from Mars, and these folks are positioned here, and we are bringing them a philosophy, a doctrine, and a language that is foreign to them.
Exactly. And
for them to promote that is the height of dishonesty. Okay?
It is, exactly.
You're absolutely correct. There's nothing that we're talking about today that hasn't been talked about in any economic hardship that this country has went through. It's been talked about as how to bring in the masses of black men and women into the workforce. And the way that they do that in the white community is they use a lot of construction jobs. They lose a lot of union jobs because the masses of black people will not appear on the cover of Ebony, Jet, and Essence. So the masses have to be brought into the workforce. Otherwise, you don't have a way to make your communities better. If you don't, right now, they're not. The college system is not providing enough resources for people to go to college like they did when I was going through because they've legislated out the resources. They found a way to give them somewhere else. So
absolutely.
Now we're back to what I call the just basic person, maybe you've gotten through high school if they've gotten through there, but we somehow have to figure out the best approach to employ the masses of young black men and women who are on the streets. And they do that in the farm community by bringing them into construction jobs. They bring them in on one level, and they can make it. They keep bringing them in. They keep advancing them until they're at heavy equipment operators and so on and so on, 4 months on the job. Well, they don't want to bring us in as people who are using brakes and hoes and picks. They don't want to bring us in at that level. So we're still fighting what you're referring to in the 60s and the 50s and the 40s. Asa Philip Randolph, all of these people have fought. How do you bring in the masses of black people into the system so that they are economically making a living? I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right. Okay.
All right, one other thing, Don, as we close out this portion, keep in mind for Lenny and ourselves that this was a part of some of the things that was said at the so-called Historical Economic Development Summit at General Mills in the late fall of 2009 under the Northwest Area Foundation and Mr. Gary Cunningham, which all of a sudden was aborted no sooner than pronouncements were made. Some of the same kind of discussion, maybe not as refined as we're having here on point. But these kinds of discussions took place. People were writing information down. They were writing statements down. People were talking in terms of coming back, you remember, in April of this year to finalize the doctrines, if you will, to issue position papers and et cetera. Because this was a problem that was on the minds of those 150 participants in General Mills. Nothing ever happened. Okay? Appreciate it.
Well, one quick thought before I go, and I appreciate you guys having me on. What we're talking about here is public policy. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Edwards and also Mr. Allen here, you understand that public policy is decided between 8 and 5 during the day. So with a lot of the people that appeared at the General Mills, and I didn't go there, but I'm going to make an assumption that they did that on a Saturday morning.
Yes,
that's right.
And
that's
then
right.
On Monday morning, when they need to go in front of the people, the powers that be said, oh, I don't have anything in front of me. I don't know if anybody said anything. No resolutions came over. Nobody showed up in the room to represent the 150 people and the voices and to say that they were back there because between 8 and 5, we're having the hardest time getting our community to stand up, and I will say it's our community to stand up in those rooms because they're working, and the ones that aren't working, they're not even bothering to come down and make that demand. If you go to the Capitol, those non-working white guys that are part of the union will show up there on Capitol Day in their dirty boots, their vests, mm-hmm. and their hard hats. So we have to somehow get them back to understanding that public policy is decided for the good or the bad of our community between 8 and 5, and we have to get more people back in the room, like the Dr. Sullivan's, I think that was the name you mentioned.
Dr.
Back
Leon
in the room,
Sullivan, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Back in the room and demanding we get our share when they're cutting the deal. I mean, that's
all
what
right.
I would, my right. my closing thought.
All right. Thank you. Thank
Thanks
you.
Very much,
Thank you very much
all
for
right.
having me.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Have a good day now, Ryan. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Wow, Mr. Edwards, that was a hot one. That was a hot one with Mr. Chisholm there.
Yes, it was, and it's good to have members of our community bring forward these kinds of reflections for the purpose of positive discussion. Not like one of our state representatives said that these are pointless, that we are pointless, if you will, pointless discussions and et cetera. In fact, it's these state legislators and federal legislators that should be pushing these kinds of discussions. I'm amazed that given the job market or the lack of here in the Twin Cities, that both of our state representatives and our federal congressman, Keith Ellison, have not conducted public hearings here. Okay,
yeah.
They can have meetings over at UROC to lullaby us to sleep about how good the light rail is going to go, but they won't allow any discussion about employment. And then when you raise the question about the issue of what will be the economic incentive, I guess, you know, some of us are told that our observations and our questions are very much pointless. Maybe we'd do better if we would paint a compodge or something, or a big picture. Maybe we could do an art thing. Like, aren't they doing art thing over on Broadway today?
Yes, and then in a couple of minutes here, we're going to get a live update from Terry Izagiri from the Minneapolis Mirror. She's going to call in a couple of minutes here and kind of give us the rundown on that.
Okay. By the way, Don, I want to make sure we let our listening audience know that this is our 90-minute segment today. And
yeah.
maybe just kind of give them the 800 number in case when we move toward taking calls that they'll have that number written down.
I was just getting ready to do that. You can call
right.
the live listeners, national, international, with our toll-free number at 1-877-572-4288. Again, that toll-free number is 1-877-572-4288. We'll be on today until looks like 6 o'clock.
No, 6:30.
6:30. Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, we're doing this is our 90-minute segment.
Yeah,
6:30.
Yeah, this is our. We have a little bit about 58 minutes left here. It looks like,
okay.
and we need
okay.
to dive into some other stuff. Now on the national forefront, we have North Korea doing a little chest bumping. It looks like.
Dangerous situation on our international segment. We're almost, because we got the international dateline, it's always in play, but we're moving towards Sunday in the Far East. About 4 or 5 months ago, after a South Korean destroyer, later to be found to have been torpedoed, an alleged international commission, which didn't have anybody from any country sympathetic to the North Koreans, said that it appeared that a North Korean submarine had torpedoed this state-of-the-art South Korean destroyer, sunk it. And
okay.
there was a loss of life. About 46 South Korean military personnel lost their lives. Right after that, the Obama administration announced that there would be joint military exercises in the waters in close proximity to where this happened, which, are, of course, are the territorial waters of both North Korea and South Korea. China, for the last number of months, has been warning the United States that this is represents a provocation that is unnecessary, that the fact of the matter is that this joint military exercise was called for after the sinking of the South Korean destroyer is nothing more than a provocation to aggravate the North Koreans, who are not impressed by the United States or the South Koreans. And as we all know, in 1950, the North Koreans and the Chinese did battle with the United States and fought to a standstill. That's why you have an armistice, if you will. Anyways, the joint military exercise, which will include a large armada of American and South Korean naval vessels, surface vessels, as we call them. Also, you have to figure that there are nuclear-powered submarines from the United States side involved, as well as a nuclear-powered American aircraft carrier. These are dangerous waters, if you will. It'll be along the what will be called the west coast of North and South Korea. It is also, though, in close proximity to China's territorial waters, if you will. China has a significant military presence in that area. The North Koreans certainly have a significant presence, and as you indicated at the top of this examination, the North Koreans have talked in terms of the possibility of a nuclear confrontation, and that's not something that's discussed every day on this planet. You know what I'm saying, Don?
No, it's not. Yeah.
And now Secretary Clinton and Defense Secretary Gates, you know, strategically were in South Korea a couple of days ago earlier in the week while we had this other controversy, the civil rights slash race controversy. And they were there, I think, in many respects to help, you know, rattle the saber, if you will. Again, my long experience as a watcher indicates that the North Koreans, just as the Chinese, are not impressed, you know, by this kind of action. And so it's kind of business as usual. Bottom line on this international piece, we just hope that nobody overreacts and pushes the wrong button. I mean, you're talking in terms of significant numbers of ships and planes and military personnel, both on the sea and on ground, because these North Koreans, I just talked to reliable sources in the last 3 hours, North Korea has escalated its presence along the DMZ. That's the demilitarized zone, which is one of the most dangerous places in the world. There has been a significant movement of North Korean military personnel. And by the way, bottom line, the North Koreans have trained on the city of Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea, the largest city in South Korea, one of the largest cities in the world, at least 87,000 artillery pieces, rockets, and et cetera. And just with one barrage, they could level at least probably a third of the city of Seoul. And so, you know, you just hope that calmer and more precise minds, precise in the sense of making sure nobody doesn't screw up, get hot-headed, if you will, is what's at play. The American media has basically been keeping it low-key until yesterday when the North Korean propaganda ministry indicated that there was a possibility of a nuclear confrontation.
Wow. Yeah, and that's just, you know, that demilitarized zone. I was in the military. We had guys that went over to Korea and kind of talked about that quite a bit. And that's an area that, like you said, very dangerous. And we don't even want to tempt or push the North Koreans in any way, shape, or form, because I think they're at their boiling point and they've had enough at
this point.
And just moving right ahead here also, you had mentioned about the kind of the media keeping things under wrap there on North Korea. We have to move to Minneapolis and talk about the recent rash again in homicide, which seems to be an ongoing topic here on Point because it's not being addressed. But I'm just looking at the July 21st, 2010 story by Sergeant Tribune columnist or reporter Matt McKinney talking about the shooting of Cordell Moore, 26. It said family members remembered the 26-year-old as someone who liked and makes his sisters laugh. And they also listed it as the city's 29th homicide. Now, Mr. Edwards, you have the background on it. What number is the young 17-year-old boy that was found in Worth Creek in North Minneapolis? If this is the 29th, what number is that young man who has been not really reported on by the mainstream media? I mean, how do we look?
Well, I hate to say it like this because it's not anything to make levity of with respect to the tragedy and the death. Mr. Grant has a family. That family certainly is heartbroken with respect to the circumstances of, first of all, his body being found in Bassett Creek and the fact of the casualty. But I have to say in kind of a cavalier manner, I guess that we would put his number in some existing number. Maybe we'll call it number 27. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But on the serious note, the fact of the matter is it was fascinating because young Mr. Grant, 17 years old, out of Brooklyn Park, no one is giving out any information at this particular point, though we know his body was found right there just on the other side of the bridge going over Bassett Creek there just off of Xerxes. The article in Tuesday's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune was outrageous. It was about maybe an inch and a half in length, if you will, and an inch high. What it basically said was it was really a message to white joggers and others that the park was safe, because it went on to say that young Mr. Grant was clearly not a victim as an outgrowth of being in the park, though that's where his body was found, okay? And that's usually a code word, Mr. Allen, as I said just seconds ago, to say the park is safe. Mr. Grant's death and murder would probably be the 34th, okay? Because as we've been reporting here on our radio blog and on our other respective, you know, your website, my website, Stubbs Program, et cetera, that we're about five or six behind homicides, yes, that have taken place here in the city that have not been reported or have been misreported and misnumbered, if you will. Now, on this one, we finally caught the Star Tribune red-handed, all right? Mr. Grant is a homicide. In fact, what happened, I watched on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday as the Sheriff's Department and others conducted an exhaustive search and for our domestic and international listening audience, the area where Mr. Grant was killed has in the past been a killing field. It is a tremendous park reserve. It includes two golf courses, if you will. Walking paths in the summer and the wintertime, it's used as a ski course, Nordic skiing, and et cetera. It is a very large reserve, if you will. About 15 years ago, a significant number of African-American females were being murdered and dumped in Theodore Worth. In fact, there are probably at least one or two bodies that are still there that have never been recovered. I mean, it is large, it is deep, it is dense, okay? In the case of Mr. Grant, we are now being told as a community that, something happened to him, but we're still working on the autopsy. The fact of the matter is, as early as Tuesday, he was found on Sunday, Don. Mm-hmm. As early as Tuesday, the coroner, the medical examiner here in Hennepin County, knew the cause of his death, all right? It was a murder. It was a homicide. And so here's a situation where you talked about Mr. Moore. He was declared as number 29. Even if you ignore the numbers that we have here on point, Mr. Grant would have been 29, Mr. Moore would have been 30.
Yes.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay. And that's the way things are worked here. Now, this comes at a bad time, by the way. Let me seem to get this in. This comes at a bad time for the park police. In our city here, for our national and international domestic audiences, our park system is so large and so sophisticated and et cetera, it has its own police force by legislative act. It has a 30-member department. These are armed officers, and then they have another 35 to 40 what are called park patrol officers who by law allegedly cannot be armed. But the 30 officers who are what is called sworn personnel are armed. And so the park board police have been having some internal problems. In fact, it's ironic that earlier in the week, while people were concentrating on this civil rights problem in Washington, the longtime chief of the Park Board Police, Brad Johnson, was quietly forced out. And a female, Lieutenant Bergstrom, has succeeded him, becoming the first female, if I'm not mistaken, of the Park Board Police. Okay. Now, one of the things that caught my attention with respect to that, and it ties into the cover-up that's going on in the case of the death of Mr. Grant, is that the day after Lieutenant Bergstrom was appointed as the new head of the park board, a Lieutenant Goodspeed, who had been initially identified a year ago as the heir apparent to Brad Johnson, was put on administrative leave. Now, for those of us in the black community, Don, as you remember, Lieutenant Goodspeed is legendary because he was involved about 5 years ago in handling a dog and being involved in a situation in which an African-American who had some mental problems was cornered on a porch and a canine was unleashed on him, and the young man's testicles were actually torn off by the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was no legal action, no grand jury, and et cetera. The young man recovered, though the mental and physical damage is permanent, and he has relocated to live with his father, his grandfather and grandmother. His grandfather is a very well-recognized and beloved minister in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, if you will. But I had always wondered when Lieutenant Goodspeed was going to get his, and I'll be doggone if he is now not on administrative leave, because there's some real problems inside the Park Police having to do with some of the same problems that we have with the Minneapolis Police Department and the celebrated investigations last summer of the Metro Gang Strike Forces, Task Forces, and et cetera. But to your question on the homicide piece, we can't get the numbers right here in the Twin Cities.
No, we can't. And if anybody wants to follow up on that, there's a story in the Star Tribune from July 22nd that talks about the lieutenant has been a subject of a complaint on the Park Board. And it also says that Johnson's departure appears to be part of a department restructuring plan. Well, they know how to spin it pretty good, don't they?
Yeah, it's better than the top. You know what I'm saying? Better than the top, yeah.
Yeah, and one thing I want to get straight to, so we're correct and accurate, is Lieutenant Rob Goodsell. They have listed here is the name on that.
Oh, did I say Goodspeed? Goodsell. Yeah. That's right, Goodsell. I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah, Goodsell. Yeah.
No problem. We just want to make sure that we're being precise and accurate on that. Now this brings us to some very interesting questions about some other things kind of moving right ahead that are going on. On my Facebook page this morning, I posted that, we're kind of at the verge of some race issues, some Amber Alerts, and some missing person reports not being filed, especially attributed to cases where it is likely that the subject would be a African American. And I don't understand, I don't linger on it, I should say, but I'm clear on why that's not happening, because we have the woman. There was a complaint put out by the woman who was she was mentally ill, missing from her house, and I think it took like 16 hours to for anybody to pick that up. And
she
ended up being found. It was in North Minneapolis. She ended up being found fine. She had some psychological problems, but there seems never to be, like the young boy found, Mr. Grant found in Bassett Creek there over at Worth Park. We had no idea he was missing in the first place.
That's absolutely correct. We've done some checking here at On Point, and there is no indication that a missing persons report was ever taken seriously by the authorities. And in fact, one of the ways that the cover-up is going on is that you see no information in the media. There's not been another story since the article, the one-and-a-half-inch article, appeared in the paper. I think it was on page 4B, if I'm not mistaken. We've still not received any indication of not only the manner of death, but how long he was in the water, if you will. Obviously, he had been there some time, and at least according to the initial statements that were made, but we don't know that. No one knows that in the general public, if you will, and we, quote-unquote, are the general public, because we do not have access, and we've not heard the public information officers for the city of Minneapolis indicate what were the circumstances. How long, like you just said, how long had he been missing? How was the report being handled? Had there been any follow-up? And et cetera, and et cetera. None of that information is forthcoming, except they got caught on this one with respect to the fact that it's clearly a homicide.
Wow. Yeah, it's a rotten shame what's going on here in the Twin Cities, from economic development to missing persons to the tragedies, violence, and no real process of accountability for those that supposedly represent us.
That's right.
And it's steadily going downhill. One thing I wanted to get to, you had mentioned this a little bit earlier, and it has something to do with the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights and having no authority on state and some of the different projects, from the baseball stadium to the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome, but having no authority to or no say in any of the process there as far as numbers and getting in minority.
In fact, Don, the appropriate word that we have a document which is an opinion a legal opinion confirmed by the city of Minneapolis in 2008, admitting that they had jurisdiction. Keyword. They have no jurisdiction over any state entity or state subdivision entity. And so consequently, they never had any authority over the ballpark. They haven't never had any authority over the University of Minnesota. They never have any, had any authority over the county. We said earlier and talked in terms of the whole issue of the county jail back in 1989 and 1990. You're absolutely on point. And it's been interesting that the city and the mayor and the current civil rights director and previous civil rights directors have stayed as far away from as possible from addressing that, if you will.
Okay. And I was listening yesterday to the public educational radio station, KMOJ.
KMOJ.
Yeah, I'm biting my tongue when I'm
You weren't in St. Paul, were you? I mean, because you can't hear them in St. Paul.
Can't hear them in St. Paul. No, they don't come over there, even with their imaginary power increase. But they were interviewing Ms. Velma Corbell, and she was stating, and I listened early in the interview because, you know, I was heading downtown, but I was in the car listening, and she hinted to she actually talked about the survey that was done, a random survey with cities of Minneapolis rating city services.
Mm-hmm.
And the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights came under the dog catchers. And,
She sure did talk about that, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. And it was kind of surprising to me because if these folks don't have any jurisdiction, as we put it, and if they have not cleaned up their particular image. See, I've been down in that office, and for full disclosure, I have a case sitting there with them, a very high-profile case. And I go down in that office, and I look around. They're in the basement of the city built, the city works building there off 3rd, and I see the people.
The health department, right, or human services building, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I go in there, and I see people, mostly people of color, probably not really huge incomes, but and then I see how they are treated by the investigators that are walking around there. It's like they rather not have anything to do with them. So Ms. Corbell has a monumental job on first fixing the organization, the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, and actually getting those current folks there in line. Now, also we know that she's restructuring the whole internal system of bringing in people, letting people go, changing statuses, and just doing some really nutty stuff, in my view. And
well, by the way, on that particular point, Don, and I assume the public announcement was made because he comes back and retakes office on, I think, the 24th of August. Michael Brown, who is kind of recycled, who was the previous acting interim executive director prior to the appointment of Michael Jordan, who we all know was forced out here a couple months ago. Michael Brown, who had been promised the position back in 2007 by Mayor R.T. Ryback, the mayor cooled on him. And so Jordan was selected. By the way, this Michael Jordan is not to be confused with the Michael Jordan who's a basketball player. They're about 10 inches shorter and certainly less talented. But anyways, Michael Brown then was shepherded over to the State Human Rights Department, where he became the head of the investigations for Velma Corbell, who was the state's human rights director for 7.5 years. She played musical chairs and has come back. And by the way, yesterday on the program on the radio station, she said that she was only going to stay for 19 months, by the way, which is interesting. And if she can't get the job done in 19 months, she's going to be moving on, leaving that $107,000 a year job. Michael Brown has been brought in back in by her in the last couple days. In fact, I find out that some council members apparently didn't even know about it. Oops.
Yeah.
He has come back in as the head of investigations, forcing out Ron Brandon. Now, Ron Brandon had been perceived as a team player and our kind of guy, you know, their kind of guy, and et cetera. Ronald Brandon is out. Michael Brown is in. Corky Marvin Taylor, the former deputy director, is out, by the way. He's been relegated. He's been dropped 3 positions. See, that's the thing that bothers me. These are people who were being touted as the cream of the crop, and now they're being forced out. Ronnie Brandon is going to regulatory services, in fact, to deal with issuance of animal licensing, et cetera. I mean, really, mm-hmm. that's what you're saying. Corky Taylor is now working for the guy that he was the boss of, Johnny Burns, if you will, who's the head of contract compliance. I don't understand what kind of and how much more confusion there's going to be over there. But in the meanwhile, the African-American community, which desperately needs the services of the statutes, notice I didn't necessarily say the department, but who desperately needs the service of the civil rights statutes of our city, find themselves without opportunity to be protected, or as they say under colored law, their franchise to be protected. So I don't understand what's happening, but Michael Brown's back. You know, I guess he'll go through the motion. I just don't know.
Yeah, and the whole thing down there just seems really peculiar. And again, I want to let people know that you can call in at 1-877-572-4288. Again, that number is 1-877-572-4288. We take callers. You just call in. We'll get to you if you're on hold now. We're waiting for an update on flow in North Minneapolis with Ms. Irizaguirre, and she has called twice, but I just told her that we're in the middle of some kind of deep conversation here. Just get back with us. I'm pretty sure she will. So next time she does call in, we'll just go ahead and take that call.
Yes, sir.
So big controversy this week. Shirley Sherrod. What happened?
Yes. It has exposed a major fight between the left and the right in America, if you will, particularly the Tea Party, who was very angry about the resolution passed in Kansas City. As we pointed out on last week's program, we happened to be in Kansas City on other business, if you will, but had a chance to monitor and go to the NAACP convention there. We heard some portions of the debate in Kansas City pertaining to the motion condemning the Tea Party of America. I mean, I'm just going to give them their right name, the Tea Party of America, as a racist institution. And so what has happened, some of their soldiers, if you will, decided to fight back. And this, actually, it started actually last, well, the Thursday before the Monday situation. Ms. Sherrod confirms that she received a series of hate emails, if you will, talking about her speech in March before a local county NAACP chapter, talking to young people about the importance of working together for racial harmony. That was the theme of the little dinner they were having there, okay? So she had an indication. The record sort of shows that on early Friday morning, she called her primary supervisor in USDA and indicated to them, let's say that probably took place, Don, on the 16th of July. She called USDA. Her supervisor indicated this happened. They said, we'll get back to you. On the early afternoon of the 18th, which was Sunday, there is indication now that O'Reilly was given certain information that pertained to the existence of this edited about 3.5 minute segment of a basically a 33 to 34 minute speech by Ms. Sherrod. On Monday the 19th, interesting enough, even though the general public did not know that Ms. Sherrod had been forced out by Undersecretary Baker, a white female who demanded, based on the fact that the White House had insisted that Shirley Sherrod offer her resignation, which was immediately accepted. In fact, she was forced to pull to the side of the highway down there in Georgia and text it in. O'Reilly already knew about that. O'Reilly already knew that she was being requested to absent herself from her position. The record shows that in the early evening or thereabouts of Monday, O'Reilly called for her immediate resignation or termination, which made him look like a significant player, right?
Yes.
By 12:50 a.m., in other words, early Tuesday morning, Roland Martin, our friend Roland Martin of CNN, I really was disappointed in that, and, of course, the NAACP, had called for the removal of Shirley Sherrod. Now, of course, whereas O'Reilly had seen the entire tape, no doubt about it, both the NAACP of 24 hours later and what happened, because I haven't seen Roland Martin since there was a confrontation between he and Shirley Sherrod on at about 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday. I haven't seen Roland Martin. But anyways, the NAACP reversed itself. And by late Tuesday, they were indicating they had been, I think the word they used down was snookered.
Yes.
I thought that was like the game of snooker. You know, that you, but they said they'd been snookered. The head of the NAACP had to go on live on a couple of programs. Later on that day, the Secretary of Agriculture, as we all know, had to do a mea culpa, if you will, apologized profusely and et cetera, and said he'd like to offer Shirley something, if you will. It appears like that what they're offering her is the position of coordinator of diversity for all USDA regional offices. Apparently, a well-paying position. As of this hour, as of the broadcast, live broadcast of this program, I'm not sure what she has done, if she has accepted or what. She has received now a telephone call from the President of the United States, which appears to indicate that he is doing some contrition, if you will. And, of course, his administration on Tuesday at the big press conference offered apologies and et cetera. In the meanwhile, now the finger pointing, of course, has been going on. The conservatives have done one heck of a job by saying that the people who dropped the ball were the NAACP and the Obama administration because they rushed to judgment. Now, I don't know what it was that O'Reilly and them rushed to and Fox News Network, but I guess we're not supposed to talk about that.
No, we're supposed to leave that alone. We're supposed to just walk away from that. One thing, coming, again with full disclosure and kind of following the conservatives here in the United States is that I'm concerned that agencies that are should be representative of black people in America kind of look the other way in some cases. And in the case of Shirley Sherrod, now we find out that this video that was leaked was edited, put together strategically to make her look bad, and with the NAACP and other organizations demanding her resignation, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Let me say something else on that, Don, that certainly we do not want to be remiss in any way. And I was absolutely taken back early Tuesday morning when I heard it come across. Also, let me say that they're just absolute kudos to the Roger Spooner family. That's the white farmer that they maintained she was discriminating against. He and his wife, Elsa, in fact, it was his wife first at about 10:40 on Tony Harris's program, 10:40 Central Standard Time on CNN. Tony Harris was able to find the Spooner family. Roger Spooner's wife came on first about 5 hours later, both his wife and himself were interviewed. They had nothing but praise for Shirley Sherrod. They talked in turn. You got to understand, this happened 24 years ago, and I apologize for not really emphasizing that. The issue that she was talking about at the NAACP confab took place in Douglas County, by the way. It was Douglas County, Georgia, where she was making a speech to the Douglas County branch of the NAACP, okay? And, she talked about that. It had happened 24 years before. She did not work for the federal government. She was a volunteer. But also, she just won, along with some other plaintiffs, it's been 30 years since they filed it. I mean, honest to God, it's been 30 years. They just won a $13 million judgment against her employee, the USDA. And no one is talking about that.
No.
I repeat that again. She, 3 months ago, won a $13 million judgment against the USDA for destroying and foreclosing on what was then the largest black farm co-op in the United States, 6,000 acres.
Are we talking about the Pickford suit?
That's right.
Yes. And
$13 million she was provided. 13, And no one talks about that. No, I mean, and we've had ample time over the last 4 days. I've watched all the big players, CNN, Fox, the network. I mean, nobody touches that lawsuit. See, my question is, how much did that really weigh in the early hours, in the initial hours, particularly on Sunday and Monday, and help the secretary make that rash and quick decision to jettison her?
Yes, exactly. And the conservatives are doing a nice little bang-up on that because I'm looking here now at a report on TPM.com where it says Representative Steve King, a Republican.
Of New York, yeah, Republican out of New York, our buddy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. For example, tweeted immediately on Tuesday morning after the Sherrod case hit the news that many Pickford claims amounts were fraud. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that they're sending out on the wire.
But you had a federal court 3 months ago, in fact, it may have been the Supreme Court itself, awarded Miss Shirley Redford and at least 15 or 16 others who were all a part of the of that co-op farm, $13 million in damages.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah, it was a mess there, and I don't know what she's going to do either. And I've been kind of like perusing the news and seeing if she's made a decision yet. And I guess there'll be some kind of formal press conference, and we'll get that information. And at this point, we haven't. I just also want to interject here. I think that locally here, just getting back to the Twin Cities for a quick minute here, I've seen some very terrible examples. Well, they're good examples, but it's not a good outcome of some of the coordinators in North Minneapolis or the so-called spokespersons, of Caucasian spokespersons, just slinging racial hatreds and statements. They have a couple blogs and forum sessions here. They have the Willard Who Mail listserv, where if you're a part of this particular mail list, you'll get emails. Like if you don't like something or something's going on in the neighborhood or you have a bed for sale or a refrigerator you want to give away, you can get on this list and it goes to a few thousand people and that who's ever signed up to this particular listserv.
Okay.
And also they have a thing here in the Twin Cities called e-democracy. And that's a larger forum, goes out to quite a few more people. And I'm actually a member of the Minneapolis forum. And this, in part, I want to let our listeners know on this Thursday, my corporate firm will be putting on an free internet training class at the University of Minnesota's UROC facility in North Minneapolis. So I thought that it's from 5:30 to 8. So I thought that it would be really good to put this on this particular e-democracy. Well, as soon as I put it in there or posted it, young lady by the name of Megan Goodmanson, who is real tight and real in with Sandra and Don Samuels of the Peace Foundation and Don Samuels, the Minneapolis Ward 5 city councilman, decided to post that people should beware because this guy used to work for the firm INET Global, which the U.S. Secret Service raided on the 23rd of February as a Ponzi scheme. And it was very strange.
And this you got, by the way, being you.
Beware of him. I'm just giving you information to be informed, she put on this particular email, that, you know, or somehow, some way that this training that my firm will be doing at UROC is somehow involved with INET Global and a Ponzi scheme. Well, what she neglected to put out there that since the February 23rd raid of INET Global, there has been no charges filed. And on this week, INET Global officially released a statement to their 75,000 membership that said, the investigation is over. No charges are filed. The U.S. government will be returning all $27 million, and the company will be reopening.
Okay.
Okay? Mm-hmm. And so it's very interesting that they give half-truths out there. But this is the same white woman that sat at a meeting about crime in North Minneapolis, and I was invited to speak on some particular issues which I had documents for. And she decided to say that he shouldn't talk. He doesn't even live in North Minneapolis. but yet she could just, you know, say what she was very, they tried to take control. And the new guy on the scene that was trying to have a meeting, you know, he was doing the chicken necking because he didn't know to listen to her or Don Samuels, Councilman Don Samuels' aide. And it just turned into a huge cluster mess. So I just want to put that out there that we're on the verge of some kind of race baiting and race war with these folks who actually do not want black folks in their neighborhood, in a black neighborhood that has been a black neighborhood for decades.
Since the early 1920s, yeah.
And so,
you know, I think that it's important, again, for the international and national audiences to understand that, contrary to what, you know, you may not be hearing, racial tensions are extremely high in both these cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, extremely high in Minneapolis. Racial tensions are higher than people want to confirm. I covered downtown over the last couple of nights, and the level of police concentration against the presence of African Americans in downtown Minneapolis is rather startling and frightening, if you will. Now, by the way, Don, this comes at a rather troubling time. Call again for purpose of documentation. Yesterday's edition, Minneapolis Star Tribune, a very compelling picture, new push to get guns off streets. Now, by the way, again, for our listening audience, this is a city that when those of us in the black bloggers talked in terms of the serious problem, people like the council member that Mr. Allen has mentioned and others maintained that we were doing nothing but stirring, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that there was no problem. Now you see headlines that talk in terms of getting guns off the streets. We see headlines talking about call for an end to hatred. We now have an announcement that there will begin to be a roundup of young African Americans here in this city to get allegedly weapons off of the streets. And, of course, the invoking of federal time, which is real hard time, for weapons charges is at play. And for those of you that maybe missed it here in our city, you may want to call the story up. Front page, Star Tribune, new push to get guns off street. Now, let me share this with you, Don, kind of exclusive here from On Point. One of the issues that is troubling the authorities here is that grenades are being brought into this part of the country, particularly by the Latino gangs. These are grenades and et cetera that are emerging out of places like Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and et cetera, who received this American hardware during the time that the United States was, quote-unquote, fighting the Cold War back in the 80s and 90s, right?
Yes.
Be advised that there is a disturbing number of grenades that are being moved into Minnesota. And as you know, as a former military person, a grenade is a very devastating weapon.
Yeah, you can kill 100 people within, if they're standing within, 25 meters of each other. You set that grenade in the middle and everyone is down.
That's right.
Arms cut off. That was one of the most dangerous trainings that I went through in the military because we had guys out there on the training field that would be out there with the drill and throw the grenade and then not duck down in time. So missing arms, eyes, ears, things like that, yes.
And these are, what are they called, the M62s?
Yeah, I think that's what they're called. They have several kinds. They have some of the ones, and some of the ones that are getting out are the old Army issues, the first ones, not the sophisticated ones that you throw in a room and they land like they're like a loaded die or something, and then
right. They
pop up into the air five.
Those are what we call, you call those bouncing Bettys.
Yes.
And
there's a variety of different grenades, and for depending on what type of job needs to be done, but that's pretty serious right there.
And keep that in mind because that's one of the undercurrents that's going on right now. The intel has come back that there is a tremendous supply. Initially, it appeared that it was just being used by the cartels in Mexico in the just bloody war that's going on there. But our sources have indicated that significant and insignificant volume, when I say volume, I'm talking about 1,000, couple thousand, have been moved across the border and are moving in the direction of heavy concentrations of populations. Also, there's a concern and a rumor at this point. Let's just say that here, and in the last 14 minutes that we're on the air, that there is concern about, there's been talk about folks being involved in bomb making. And this is one of the reasons up here, my friends, on our international scene, that there's been so much concentration against the Somali community with respect to so many young Somali men who have disappeared from Minnesota and have shown up and wound up in Mogadishu.
Okay.
All right.
Well, on that bomb-making tip, there is a gentleman in North Minneapolis who actually is a blogger who has been making little homemade bombs, like for fireworks and things like that, and stuff he's learned on the internet. Yet the City Pages ranked him as the number one blogger in the Twin Cities.
Right.
Yeah, and some other stuff. And it seems to me they're pretty much ignoring what's going on with this particular gentleman. And it's I'm not even going to give him the credit and say his name, but
no.
When you go to the blog, you see pictures of black men and their criminal records. If he doesn't like a particular black-owned business, like the mattress store over there, Mr. Edwards, and to our local listeners on Broadway right off Sheraton there by the QVC and the Midas, well, they had some storm damage. And his first story was that, hey, there's storm damage in North Minneapolis. Then his second title to cover this black-owned business was, oh, thank God Almighty, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the roof got blown off this black business where they have alleged gambling and drinking. You know, and so they do that quite a bit, and that's something. Go ahead.
Without going into too much detail of our own intelligence network, you know, he made a mistake with respect to some references to bomb making, because unfortunately for him, he came to the attention of the ATF, who were looking around for information with respect to bomb making going on in the Somali community, and also this situation of these grenades that are coming out of Mexico. And he got himself caught in a bind. I hope he can weasel out of it. I imagine that ATF agents, alcohol tax, and firearms, for those that don't know, I assume he's been able to explain his expertise in bomb making.
Well, even more, I hope Diane Hofstede, city councilperson, can explain why she was looking on smiling while the little homemade things were being blown up. Okay.
Yes. I know there's an explanation. You know what I'm saying?
It's somewhere there. They'll figure it out, or else the mayor's aide, Sherman Patterson, can try to run them out the back door. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What else do we? Oh, one other question. A couple of our education listeners. Do we have any idea when the test scores for the Minneapolis Public Schools will be officially released? We're about 3 weeks behind. I mean, we're hearing rumors, and I'd like to have those rumors laid to rest. Maybe Superintendent Johnson can help us. The rumors are that the most recent state, or in this case, Minneapolis Public Schools citywide tests, were an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
And by law, the State Department of Education indicates that those tests will be out by the first week in July, and we're kind of in the middle of July here, and I was just wondering, so we can get a pretty good fix on what it is we have to fix in the area of education as it pertains to the miseducation of the sons and daughters of the African.
Yes. You know what? They are so caught up, Mr. Edwards, and you know this as well as I do. The school board, Minneapolis Public School System, which under the auspices of Dr. Richard Green back in the 70s and 80s, which was a national model for every public school system in the United States, has now gotten to the point where they can barely graduate anybody. Okay,
absolutely.
Children of color, Mississippi, Kentucky, Alabama, Tennessee, Florida, Texas, these places that were never really did great with people of color outrank us in graduating children of color, and not only that, sending them to college. Okay?
You're absolutely on point, sir. I can remember a time when we used to tell jokes around here about those states that you mentioned. In many categories now, particularly in education, housing, and et cetera, we in the state of Mississippi switch places depending on what the subject matter and issues are. And I find that to be astounding when you talk about the amount of money that citizens in Minnesota pay compared to what people in Mississippi pay. And yet there is such a deficit, if you will, primarily amongst the populations of color. And that's why I decided, upon the request of some educators, to raise the question here on point, where are the test scores for this year? I mean, last year was just an absolute disaster. I don't know how many schools we have that are slated to be technically put in what is called educational receivership. In other words, oh, here we use the term fresh start.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, just getting back to that real quick, I remember the school board had their second meeting after that first one we were at, where we requested some specific items.
Right.
And so I think they're so caught up in this, delivering this this school board headquarters over on Broadway Avenue that the test scores, I think, are just sitting on a second tier somewhere. Because once that comes out, and once what we already know is distributed to the masses, there should be, we hope, there will be some kind of outcry. But if you notice the trend here over the last 6 months since January, and this is the trend I'm talking about, African-Americans or Black Americans or Black Minnesotans getting involved in these processes, is that they'll walk this stuff right through us. Just like those meetings at these community meetings for the district headquarters for Minneapolis Public Schools. It's advertised as a community meeting. They advertise it to a very few. Now, you were at the first one, Mr. Edwards. They had name tags for everyone they wanted to be there.
Yeah, yes, it is. Yes,
you can't did. You can't do that when you invite the community. You know,
right.
And it was very shocking, very interesting to just see the process with they're 15 strong, and there's probably six community members in the Capri Theater the last couple of meetings. And I'm asking them, I says, well, how come you don't tell the community what's going on? I mean, how come there's six community members and there's 15 deep over here, including Jackie Cherry Holmes, Giselle Jones, and a couple other folks that are involved in
development,
you know, circle.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't make any sense. So I'll be surprised to actually see those numbers. You know, we're coming around to about 7 minutes, and I have a few announcements that we need to make.
All right, let's get them out there.
Yeah.
One question, though, before we get them. Did we ever get the information on the district's new headquarters there along the 1200 block of West Broadway? Did we get the information of who will have the sweetheart insurance and bonding package?
I was told that we are here to talk about the design.
Oh, they didn't have any information for you?
No, they did not.
Oh, man. You know, they may be in violation of state law, because demolition, by the way, which is a part of, an integral part of the beginning of a project, state law requires that there is a specific timeline, like probably 90 days or if not more, that all that information has to be on file. And that information being who will handle the bonding and who will handle the insurance, because you don't want to begin, as an example, demolition, because first of all, they have to tear the current site down to prepare for the beautiful new district headquarters. The schedule that we saw, that we've been handed and has been certified by the district, indicates that the district will begin demolition the first week in October. Am I correct, Mr. Allen?
You are correct, and that's not the same thing I thought at the last meeting. Yes, sir.
And I'm puzzled now, once again, for the good of the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis, where is the legal information that is required by law identifying who's insuring and who is providing the bonding for the site? And you said that information was not given to us at the meeting at the Capri of a week and a half ago?
Again, and I quote, we are here to talk about design.
Okay. All right. Well, let me leave that alone, and let us get on with the announcement. You're right. We're down to about 6 minutes. All right, Mr. Allen.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to let our listeners know, and for the archive of this radio show, is that we'll be back on next week with 90 Minutes at 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. for On Point, the same URL. You just come to this channel, and we'll be right there. We have consistent shows going out through the rest of the year at this time. And if there's a delay or obstruction or a cancellation, we'll certainly give you advance notice. Secondly, the Joey Browner Foundation, you know, former All-Madden team star and Minnesota Viking legend Joey Browner has started a foundation. Well, he's had a foundation, but what he's doing now is he has Canterbury Downs on August 15th. So on next Friday, downtown Minneapolis at J.D. Hoyt's on the corner of 3rd and Washington, Minnesota Viking legend Joey Browner would be down there signing autographed pictures and memorabilia and also promoting his race for the fundraiser for his foundation, his educational foundation, at Canterbury Downs. Tickets are $10, and with that $10 ticket, you get sitting up in the VIP club room area. That includes a hot dog, a drink, and some chips, and the program, the coupon booklet. And he also has a $50 level, which includes the buffet in the clubhouse, the coupon booklet, and some other amenities.
And you can bet on the ponies.
You can bet on the ponies, exactly. And then also, he is also promoting and selling tables of 10 for $350. So, you know, at $50 per person, and he's selling tickets for tables of 12, you know, you get like almost a $250 discount there at that $350 rate. But we'd like to invite all the local folks here from the Twin Cities out to J.D. Hoyt's next Friday for Joey's promotional, and that's next Friday, the 30th of July, from 5 o'clock till 7 p.m., and I'll get some notice here up on the On Point blog and on our respective blogs, and so that people can come out and you know, shake his hand, talk to him. He's a good guy. He does a lot of good work here in the Twin Cities. Just recently, a young boy got his eye blown out on 4th of July, some fireworks, and Joey shows up at his house with a football and a jersey. And the guy, he's the happiest little guy, his dad, that he's so happy that a Viking came out to see him. And
by the way, you're going to be showing that, I know you've already received approval behind the privacy issue. You're going to be showing that that very moving scene on your YouTube, aren't you?
Yes, I'm going to show that. And also, I have actually, if you go to the IBNNnews.com, that's IBNNnews.com, and you scroll down, there are already pictures up and what had happened out there that day. I mean, it was just the whole story was right there, so it was incredible. Yes, we do have that up already.
Okay, very, very good. I know the family of the young man in question who unfortunately lost his eye in that 4th of July accident was just very moved and very appreciative of Joey Browner's commitment and humanitarian actions, if you will.
Yeah, and just one thing on that note, too, I just want to add something. It's very important because there was a time when a young boy like that, something would happen, and he'd have not only his family, but he'd have the church people, he'd have the local politician, he'd have, you know, a few more athletes, and it would actually make news, and they would help a family out that was, you know, not really doing, 100% well, but, you know, this is an expense. And,
right.
And you don't see that, you know, that giving, that loving, that sharing, you know, anymore, you know, and this little kid, like I said, their whole family just lit up. It was like being on a cloud, just you were lightheaded, just seeing this happen in real time, you know, and it was a good piece. Okay,
right.
We have about 90 seconds left in the show, and I just like to let everybody know, tomorrow, 5 p.m., Minneapolis Television Network, MTN Channel 17, Mr. Edwards' television show, Black Focus. You can tune in. It's Channel 17, Minneapolis Television Network. If you are in Minneapolis on Comcast, you can see that show at 5 p.m. Get informed, detailed information, and what's going on here in the city.
Don, let me just cut in very quick. I figure we got 30 seconds. Tomorrow, Sunday's program, by the way, we are announcing the gang summit that will take place Wednesday afternoon here in the city of Minneapolis. Very secret summit. Very, very interesting. Get a chance, tune in tomorrow on Channel 17. Appreciate it, Don.
All right, thank you, thank you. And also, you know, as always, I have the Independent Business News Network, which is www.ibnnnews.com or Donnie with a Y-Allen.us. You can get there both ways. And we look forward to having you back next week. Again, this is On Point with your hosts Don Allen and Ron Edwards. We'll be back next week, same time, same station on Blog Talk Radio. We now have Black Talk Radio.
Yes, we do.
Yes. Thanks.
Thank you.
And good day. Anything else in closing? We have 10 seconds.
That's it. Thank you.
Okay, I will talk to you.